Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, in a minute or so, Greg Grandin reviews the retreat of the social democratic wave in Latin America. And then at the bottom of the hour, Ashton Applewhite diffuses aging of its shame and terror. First, Greg Grandin. He's a professor of history at NYU, specializing in Latin America, and a prolific author who's been on the show several times to discuss his books, most recently Kissinger's Shadow, his investigations of Hillary Clinton's ghoulish friend. Beginning most notably with the election of Hugo Chavez as president of Venezuela in 1999, politics in Latin America took a decided left turn after the dismal neoliberal years of the 1980s and 1990s. All of those reforms yielded little of the promised growth, but instead a lot of polarization and subordination to foreign capital and Washington's commands. The left turn, nicknamed the Pink Tide, was reinforced by the election of Lula as president of Brazil and Nestor Kirchner as president of Argentina, both in 2003. Bolivia, Honduras, and Paraguay then joined the trend. But in recent years, it's all been falling apart, partly because the second generation of leaders lacked the skills and charisma of the first, and partly because the commodity boom, driven by once relentless Chinese demand, which pumped up the exports of most Latin countries, lost steam, and money soon became short. A neoliberal government took over in Argentina early this year, the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, is on the verge of impeachment, and Venezuela is a mess. Here's Greg Grandin with an analysis and even some words of encouragement. What was once a rather hopeful trend in Latin America, nicknamed the Pink Tide, seems to be receding. Any thoughts on the general phenomenon before we talk about some specific countries?
Yeah, well, it's definitely in recession. It seems like what was this very robust project that was both specific to Latin America, but then tied into the larger BRICS, you know, the Brazil, Russia, India, and China, is really in tatters. I mean, you just do a quick survey in Argentina and Venezuela and Brazil. These were the kind of trio of countries that were supposed to anchor it in different ways, and that in many ways set a number of precedents, whether it be pushing back on the bondholders with Argentina, getting some kind of control over resources and energy as in Venezuela, or emerging as a kind of political hegemon that could create a new center of gravity vis-a-vis the United States, such as Brazil. They're all in crisis, or they've all been retaken by Wall Street. And then what we have left is a bunch of kind of smaller, fragmented national projects in Bolivia and Ecuador and maybe Nicaragua and Uruguay, that it seems without those other three larger countries are left to fend for themselves, and one wonders how they're going to last. But just to step back and just to remind listeners what was at stake, and you know, in 2002, Lula was elected president of Brazil, and he was inaugurated in 2003, and that really, it was him and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela that were the beginning of it. And they presided over what was, I don't think, no matter how breathless the recession has been and the collapse has been, I don't think it should take away the achievements. They pushed back on U.S. militarism. They completely sidelined the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which was supposed to be the crown jewel and the crowning achievement of the Washington Consensus. And they managed to really chart out an alternative and quite a successful political project for two decades. But it seems like since Chavez's death to the impending impeachment of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, it's just been swept away with a remarkable alacrity.
Okay, let's talk about two large phenomena which might be having a substantial influence on this receding pink tide. One is the commodity boom that was driven by Chinese growth. Chinese growth is slowing. The commodity boom has lost a lot of air. How important do you think that is in this apparent turn to the right in much of Latin America?
Well, it seems on the face of it, it has had a huge impact. A large component of the pink tide of the turn to the left was not really so much challenging the economic model, but trying to diversify it a bit, and not so much diversify it in terms of the commodities or the industries, but diversify it in terms of capital and credit to break free of the United States and to look to other markets and other, and that did work for a while. But with the collapse of oil prices, the collapse of copper prices, the collapse of soy prices and soy demand, I think it's undeniable that this has had a huge effect. Part of it also was the bet, good or bad, by the Latin American left to work within the electoral system. I mean, that was part of the Washington consensus that actually did triumph, and there were limitations to what these political movements could do. And a lot of the wounds were self-inflicted, the corruption in Brazil, the corruption and chaos in Venezuela, without doubt. So I think you have, on the one hand, the limitations of the electoral model, which kind of allows for a festering of the kind of corruption which rots the project from inward, and then the reliance and dependence on commodities. And it turns out there's quite a lot of truth, it seems, to old school dependency theory.
There's a guy in the Clinton's National Security Council, I can't remember his name, but he said that democracy only works when there's fundamental agreement on the nature of property. By agreeing to work within the electoral system, were there any real fundamental challenges to bourgeois property relations?
Well, I think so. I think the whole project represented a challenge to bourgeois property relations. I think Latin America, in some ways, its historic role, a trend that goes well beyond, that predates the current pink tide and its recession, has been to advance a kind of social conception of property that's embedded in almost every country's constitutional framework. It's in some ways you can make the argument that it's more subversive than a kind of Leninist all-out rejection of bourgeois property, but to actually advance a notion that property rights are relative to a larger social good. I think it's by its very definition is provides for contestation and gives traction to social movements. Obviously there's limitations to what can be done. And certainly part of the pushback and the retaking of Latin America by the bond markets has been, I think if you just look at the case of Argentina, right? For a while, countries like Argentina and Ecuador had managed to make a compelling case that certain debt is illegitimate and immoral. And I think what we see now with Argentina completely capitulating to the vulture funds is a return to an absolutist notion of private property as manifest in these bond holdings.
And the other large trend I'm thinking of is the U.S. was very, very distracted by the Middle East for a decade or more, and not paying much attention to Latin America, at least as close as historically as it has. Do you think the U.S., Washington now is turning its attention towards Latin America with unfortunate results?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Obama has been very shrewd and very smart. He hasn't obviously been as provocative in Latin America as the Bush administration was at different points and in different places, and in some ways biding time and playing a long game. The narrative, the argument that the Bush administration wasn't paying attention to Latin America kind of obscures the degree into which the Washington consensus and neoliberalism collapsed on its own terms. The complete, Mark Weisbrot talks about this all the time, the complete disaster of growth rates between 1980 and 2000. That's what led to the rise of the left, not that Washington wasn't paying attention to the region. But certainly the Bush administration was more provocative around issues of national security, war, trade, that allowed a coalition of the left and the center left to take shape. And the Obama administration, I think, has been quite shrewd in holding back. I think the way that U.S. foreign policy works is that there are multiple vectors. To a large degree, there's significant plurality in interests of the U.S. and how they apply to Latin America. Democracy promotion groups, which destabilized Honduras, for instance, I don't necessarily see that as a very coherent policy of the Obama administration, but it certainly lends itself to a coherence of consequences. What we saw in Honduras, this kind of constitutional coup, played itself out again in Paraguay, these very, you know, low-hanging fruit with the overthrow of, through constitutional means, of Fernando Lugo, and now we're seeing it on a large scale in Brazil. The degree that the U.S. is actively promoting that, I think there's certainly interests involved, but I also think that Obama has been quite smart at just letting the consequences play out and fall to the favor of the U.S.
I've had a couple of long interviews with Alfredo Saad Filho talking about Brazil over the last few weeks. But just a few words about what's going on there. You would agree that this is some sort of coup in constitutional disguise.
Yeah, and this is nothing specific. I mean, I think to the degree it's a media coup, to the degree it's a constitutional coup, but this is a longstanding tradition in Latin America, the use of, you know, legal justifications to remove a president that capital and oligarch interests find unpalatable. This is not unique to Brazil, and it has a long genealogy. But yes, it seems fairly clear that collapsing economy and missteps on the part of Dilma Rousseff has led her class enemies to regroup and their allies within the media, the global corporation and things like that, under the guise of anti-corruption. It's one of the most corrupt impeachment processes that one could imagine, and it's clear that it's fueled by both the interests of the oligarchy as well as a certain kind of race resentment that the Workers' Party was redistributing wealth, not just economically excluded people, but racially marked distinct people to the northeast of Brazil, the poorer parts of the country. There's a geographic dimension that people in the U.S. would quite recognize.
Brazil, also Venezuela and Argentina, we had presidents who were second acts, heirs to significant figures. Is there something of a succession problem here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a succession problem. And for a little while, it did seem as if the Latin American left would outlast its first generation of leaders, but it seemed like that was a misplaced hope. What is interesting, and I would like to mention, is what gives me hope about the Latin American left. First of all, it's Latin America, so the left is always coming back, right? There are these cycles, but this is certainly obviously not the last of the kind of a left project, that social democratic developmentalist project. I mean, if it survived the Cold War and the repression of the Cold War and the horrors of neoliberalism, it's going to survive this downturn. But what gives me the most hope is the more flexible relationship that these developmentalist parties, be it the PT in Brazil or the MAS in Bolivia or Venezuela, is a much more fluid and flexible relationship it has with the social movements. You know, I go back and I think about the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and it was much more vertical. You know, you had these developmentalists that were vertically tied into these social movements, whether it be, you know, usually around peasants and labor, and when the party or the leader was overthrown or turned or became corrupt or became repressive, the whole system collapsed because of that rigid relationship. I think what you're going to have now is that these social movements aren't going to go away just because the PT is being driven out of power, you know, or there's chaos among the political elite in Venezuela, or the MAS in Bolivia under Evo Morales has become detached from its roots. I think these social movements are very strong, they're flexible, and they're going to outlast the current recession on an electoral level. And that's one thing that kind of gives me hope.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, who teaches at NYU. And now Venezuela, it looks to be a mess from afar. People who are loyal to the leadership say it's not as bad as it looks. How bad is it?
I mean, I just read the stuff that you read. I mean, it looks bad. I mean, those lines seem real. You know, a lot of that reporting is engaging. Is it reporting on the solidarity that exists on a grassroots level, on how basic goods are distributed, how people manage this crisis? You know, I think that the social base of Chavismo is stronger than a lot of the sensationalist reporting would have it. But I think things are pretty bad. I think Nicolas Maduro hasn't quite been, you know, there was a sense that he was going, that the whole process was going to start all over again. If you think of, you know, the 10 or so, the decade, the 14 years of Hugo Chavez's government, there was a process of learning how to socialize the opposition, socialize the bourgeoisie. And with Chavez's death, the process started all over again, but with collapsing oil prices and with Maduro not being as skilled a broker as Chavez was. I think that the crisis is real and endemic, and it's unclear what the resolution is going to be.
And they really didn't do much diversifying away from oil during the Chavez years, did they?
No, but that's a difficult project, right? I mean, the oil curse, and there were different efforts to do it. It just, no, there wasn't.
And, well, the Saudis are trying to do it too, but we'll see if they can do it. Then Honduras, our likely future president, had a pretty heavy hand there. Let's talk about Hillary and Zelaya.
Yeah, well, Manuel Zelaya was a politician from the Liberal Party. He was elected, I don't remember exactly what year he was elected, but he was overthrown in 2009. And throughout the course of his tenure, he moved steadily to the left. He began to support social movements.
Now, he didn't start there, right? He came out of a fairly elite background?
He came out of a fairly elite background, a rural background, an agrarian background. His father was a rancher. He was a rancher. He had a certain degree of paternalism. The Liberal Party in Honduras had an agrarianist tradition, a kind of social liberal, social democratic tradition that was largely snuffed out in the 60s. And in some ways, Zelaya represented a return to that kind of social liberalism or social democracy. And again, but much more diverse and plural. I mean, Zelaya, for a rural patriarch, was very supportive of gay rights. He made moves to legalize the morning after pill. He represented a certain kind of 21st century politics and social movement politics. And he began to shift the balance of power, and he was a threat, and he was overthrown. And the details of that have been rehearsed many times. And Hillary Clinton's role in that was, as the rest of the hemisphere and much of the world was demanding that Zelaya be reinstated, Clinton helped legitimate the coup regime by brokering elections that basically iced out Zelaya. And
they ran out the clock in his term, right?
Yeah, they ran out the clock. And so Clinton took a lot of credit for that. Belén Fernández, in her chapter in the Liza Featherstone book on what is faux feminism, she noticed that Clinton basically edited, cut out the whole chapter on Honduras as her book Hard Choices moved from the hardcover to the paperback.
Yeah, she had a very dishonest account of it in the hardcover, which is what I read, and it disappeared.
But it was a dishonest account that she was proud of, and then she cut that out completely from the paperback version. And so, it's just interesting because, look, all of the people that moved to support Zelaya, those social movements were exactly the kind of intersectional social movements that Hillary Clinton claims to be supporting in the United States, you know, when she says that women's rights are human rights.
And now Argentina, I was at a presentation at a hedge fund conference recently where one of the big hedge funds who's long Argentine bonds is not very happy. Was just cheerleading for the new government, the Macri government, a reassurance that the whole world is not turning towards populism. What's happened there?
Yeah, well, I mean, Argentina was key. We, you know, at the beginning, we talked a little bit about how Argentina, Venezuela, and Brazil worked together to push back the Washington Consensus. And one of the key actions that Néstor Kirchner, who was president of Argentina from, I believe, 2003 up until
2007, it was.
2007. Basically broken, renegotiated $100 billion worth of debt, got a very good deal. But there was a group of recalcitrant holdouts that wouldn't accept that deal. And they harassed Argentina. It seemed to be a kind of lost cause for quite a long time. But then with new government, Mauricio Macri, they managed to reach a settlement. And these vulture funds swept in, purchased up a lot of that debt, even after the settlement that Kirchner broke it in 2004, 2005. So this is, in many ways, the triumph of that kind of notion of property rights when it comes to bond markets that we talked about earlier. It's quite staggering in its implications. And
Well, no, we had some softer left governments elsewhere, in Chile, for example. Any change there?
Michelle Bachelet also has a series of crises and scandals that has lowered her popularity and kind of set things back. You know, what's interesting, I mean, what's more interesting is how the free trade agreement of the Americas, which was defeated by, that was one of the high points of the Latin American left, has basically been replaced by the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You could think of the TPP as a response to the failure of the free trade agreement of the Americas. And I'm just using this to answer the question about Chile, because what the TPP, if the free trade agreement of the Americas was meant to organize all of Latin America under a kind of neoliberal regime anchored by the United States, with the failure of that, the TPP came back and was set up as a divide and rule, incorporating Chile and a number of other Pacific Coast countries and Mexico into this free trade regime that is organized around the Pacific Rim and isolating Brazil, cutting out Brazil and cutting out China, and meant to put pressure. And so this goes back to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was a big supporter of the TPP when she was the Secretary of State, and what became the beginnings of the TPP. And now as candidate, she's opposing it. But there's already
we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, well, there's already a move to reimagine the TPP as a security treaty, a national security treaty. So one could see that as laying the foundation for yet another pivot.
Now, you mentioned Mexico. Mexico never really participated in this the social democratic wave, did it?
Not in terms of electoral success, but there's been social movements on the ground, and there was a number of Manuel López Obrador's campaign, which almost won the presidency. No, it was always much, and that goes, if you wanted to tell the history of the Western Hemisphere and by trade treaties, in some ways it was because NAFTA had already locked Mexico into the U.S. and didn't really have, there's ways in which the pink tide could be understood as a specifically South American as opposed to Latin American phenomenon. It was about organizing South America and kind of conceding in some ways Central America and Mexico, there's been a number of leftist governments in Central America.
Now, of course, the standard line in the capitalist press is that this reversion of the pink tide is the result of voter discontent with the mismanagement of the economies by the left, and we're getting back to normal. Well, you don't subscribe to this theory.
You know, I think the electoral model does have some built into it some liabilities, including a tendency towards corruption. I mean, a lot of the corruption that we're seeing in Brazil had to do with the PT having to make deals with other parties, right? So there's a lot of tendency towards corruption built into the electoral system. I think just to dismiss it as the mismanagement and a return to a more normative model of free trade, I think is obviously a wrong way of thinking about it. And I don't think the left in Latin America is going anywhere. I think what we saw was a learning curve among the right. There were different ways in which the right tried to figure out ways of pushing back and organizing itself, and then a combination of these kind of electoral coups or constitutional coups, again, Honduras and Paraguay in some ways being the prototype or the training ground for what is now going on in Brazil, as well as the right in Latin America developing a degree of unity as time went on. I think that these kind of standard conventional narratives about mismanagement and the return to what is a more normative way of organizing the economy obviously missed the larger picture.
And finally, there seemed to be some nostalgia on the streets of Brazil for the military government and some really bloodthirsty sounding slogans being chanted and put up on placards. There's not much of a chance of return to military governance, though, is there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would think not. But I think the crisis is fairly profound. I think it would be impossible to overstate just how deep the crisis is beyond politics. And it shades into culture. It shades into things, almost everything that Brazil was rightly proud about under the kind of good times of the PT government in the 2000s and the early 2010 have been turned on its head. The Zika virus, the scandals around oil, the scandals around the Olympics. I think the crisis is quite profound. And I think that dressing it up as anti-corruption created a certain sense of universalism, obscured the class basis of the drive against the Workers' Party in Brazil. I think that's kind of dissipating. I think the polarization is now becoming much more apparent. Where Brazil winds up is anybody's guess, but I think that it could, I think there's a very real possibility it could spin out of control.
That was Greg Grandin, a professor of history at NYU, author most recently of Kissinger's Shadow, and a frequent contributor to The Nation. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henward, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Schwule Vier, Reel 4, by Kraftwerk, from Ich, 1972. That expression of anxiety at the passage of time is a good lead-in to my next guest, Ashton Applewhite. Her book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism, was published in March by Networked Books. It's not widely available in stores, but is easily available on Amazon. I have to admit that the topic of aging makes me nervous, though I doubt I'm alone in that. And I put off reading Ashton's book for a while. And I'm glad I finally did. The act of confronting the text is itself a great anxiety binder. Her book is engagingly written and rather persuasive, though I'm not fully there yet, I have to admit. Ashton Applewhite. Welcome, Ashton. I have to admit that this is a topic that makes me nervous. We're exactly the same age, so we've been... I guess you get that reaction often. Do people say, just freak out when they hear what you're writing about?
They aren't often so candid about admitting it, so I appreciate your candor. There is a difference between aging and dying, and there is a difference between aging and ageism, which is, of course, discrimination on the basis of age, although people not infrequently say, what is ageism?
Well, okay, what's your definition?
My definition is treating people differently, individual or a group, on the basis of how old you think they are.
So this is some subjective perception and not just a mathematical
concept. Well, I can concept. Never... Can you tell how old people are?
I guess, more or less. I mean, you never know.
Generally, of course, it's more broad because it involves stereotyping, as all prejudice does. And you think, oh, they're significantly older slash younger, therefore they will or won't be interested in X or be able to do Y or be fun to sit next to. It just as if we made the same sort of assumptions about someone's skin color or someone's gender, that's prejudice.
By your definition, it also applies to young people as well as
Absolutely.
Older people, right?
Yeah. Every time we, you know, assume that a younger person is too inexperienced to know how to do something, or likewise, wouldn't be, what would I have in common with that kid if I sit next to her? That's an assumption on the basis of age. And sometimes there's a basis for fact, but not usually.
American society, in contrast with other, you know, rich countries, does seem more age segregated than most. I mean, I recall being in a bar in Amsterdam and there's, you know, like an 80-year-old and a 16-year-old. And
yeah.
It's just, you don't see that so much
like
here.
There was
you?
A thing in the feature in the Sunday Times magazine about Iceland, about communal pools. And everyone showers together, so they see bodies of all sizes and shapes and ages naked. And then they hang out in these pools where you can not talk to anyone or talk to people. Then you go back to apparently your fairly sort of aloof Icelandic ways. Or the British pub. You know, you see all ages in British pubs. So it's true. American society does seem to lack. I mean, even church groups tend to be segregated, you know, from Sunday school to teen whatever to senior suppers. We are, and you know, urbanization is also a segregating factor.
Yeah, well, this neighborhood is, I'm certainly at the high end of the age distribution. Well, you're in Williamsburg, which is even more
I'm older than you, and I live in Williamsburg, so.
Yes, I'm sure you feel it. Well, and also sex. I mean, women, older women are perceived much differently from older men.
Very much so. I mean, Susan Sontag called it the double standard of aging. You know, the idea that a guy turns into a distinguished silver fox and a woman just, her shelf life just drops off and she might as well cease to exist. But men feel the bite of ageism, too. And for white men, it's often the first form of discrimination they encounter.
Yeah. You know, I've actually refused when people offer me senior discounts. I said, no, thanks.
Well, give me a call when you get over that. I mean, if society weren't ageist, that wouldn't be embarrassing, right?
Right.
I mean, it's a whole other issue of whether they should offer discounts on the basis of age versus on the basis of socioeconomic status. You can argue that the entire policy is ageist. But frankly, let's take a more neutral example of a seat on the bus. I think that we should offer a seat on the bus in such a way that the person can say no to anyone who looks like they could use the seat, regardless of age.
Well, of course, the fear of aging, though, is related to the fear of death. We all feel, you know, decay
Ish.
And death.
But, I used to think so.
Okay, tell me why I'm wrong.
You are not wrong, but it's more nuanced than that, I think, in that fear of death is universal. You know, it's why we have Bach. It's why we have churches. And every individual and culture struggles to come to terms with it. But fear of aging is culturally constructed. I mean, there are now pretty much not being eliminated, but being reduced by the flow of global capital. There are cultures where older people are venerated. Ancestor worship, Confucianism, right, contribute to that. So there are cultures that venerate their older members. And if the proverbial boat is sinking in those cultures, they save the mother, not the baby, because their cultural values are that you could have another baby and that the past has value. And the point is not that one ethic is better than another, but that they are culturally constructed and therefore malleable.
You know, the American ideal, though, has always been, you know, you move on.
Very much so.
The road and all this.
And you must continue to make upward progress rather than a more Taoist circular view of life, which incorporates decay and slowing down as part of the natural cycle of life. So that is not our friend in thinking about this. But aging is living. We are aging from the minute we are born. Dying is just what happens at the end of all that living. And of course, older people are reminders of mortality. So the link that you point to is real, it exists, but is also greatly overstated and emphasized in an ageist society. And one of the many things I learned coming to this, if you had told me I would be fascinated by aging 10 years ago, I would have said you were smoking crack, is that the older people get, the less afraid of dying. I just assumed you would wake up and feel the shadow of the Grim Reaper ever closer and find it more and more scary. And it does not work that way psychologically.
Well, how'd you get into this topic?
I got into the, with 2020 hindsight, I got into the topic because I was in my mid-50s and I was starting to think about age with a capital A, aging. And I was afraid. And I am kind of a bull by the horns kind of person, I guess, and my mother-in-law, who at the time was in her 80s, she and her husband are booksellers, and she said, why don't you write about something people ask us all the time, which is, so when are you going to retire? And that was sort of a safe path. It was positive. You know, I started interviewing people in their 80s and 90s who work. They were amazing. And that was sort of a safe passage into the more murky, larger territory of aging. But what happened was I also started researching longevity, and when I realized that so many of my basic assumptions about what it was like to be that old were completely erroneous, then I started to think, well, why don't we know these things? And of course, we don't know them because we live in an ageist and also sexist and patriarchal and capitalist society.
Where your worth is your productivity. You know, if your productivity
conventional economic bit, yes. Productivity, indeed. And that's, of course, one reason ageism also affects the very young. It disproportionately affects the people who are least conventionally economically productive.
Yeah, and we should emphasize that point, because there's a lot of scorn among, you know, Xers and boomers for the millennials. Like they're, you know, just shallow and greedy and all kinds of terrible things. Like, this is just, like, this generational business is really
ridiculous.
A whole lot of nonsense, isn't
no,
it?
No, it's always a straw man. It divides the workers against each other. And also, you know, I think it's important to recognize that when you talk about allocating resources, whether it's jobs or you always hear this cropping up around healthcare that we have, why should we spend money on old people who are going to die soon, even though the who are going to die soon doesn't get said out loud, but it's implicit, when we could spend it on kids. And you would never, ever accept an argument of the same nature that we should allocate resources, right, according to sex or according to race. And it is no more ethically acceptable when it comes to age.
People love to quote this statistic about what percentage of Medicare spending is on people in the, you know, the last year of life. And I, whenever I hear that, I think, well, most of the fire department spending is on buildings on fire.
Exactly. And that's also spent on 18-year-olds in their last year of life, right? So it's not a lot of the things that people die of are conditions that we acquired in youth. They are not all diseases of old age. But lastly, as you say, you know, that is what the system was designed for, you know, to help people remain autonomous if they cease to be able to support themselves in conventional means. And isn't that secretly what you would like when you, if it happens that you are not able to be economically productive anymore? That's the whole damn point.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that people say about aging. One is the loss of mental power. True? How true?
20% of the population escapes mental decline entirely. And most of the rest of us will end up somewhere in the middle. I mean, one of the statistics that completely stopped me in my tracks very early on, almost 10 years ago, was I figured the odds were decent that I would end up in a nursing home, you know, some gruesome linoleum hallway. And the percentage of the entire population over 65 in nursing homes is 4%, down from 5% in the last decade. And I believe it's 3/4 of that 4% that does have severe dementia. The other people are out in the community. They are able to enjoy their lives and be out in the world. Most of us will experience some decline in specific kinds of processing capacity. Where are my, you know, damn keys? What's the name of the movie that I went to? What's his name? You know, last week. But for most of us, that's as far as it goes. That's the point. That when you forget your keys, you know, when I lost the car keys in high school, I didn't call it a junior moment. We forget things our whole life long. While we do experience some, typically, you know, there are people who don't and people who have it worse, some impairment in specific mental functions, it doesn't get in the way of us going about our lives. It's a little irritating and a little embarrassing, but that's why God invented Post-its.
It was said that a while back that the baby boomers were going to be slow to retire. They were going to stay working for a long time. And that seems not to be the case. They seem to be withdrawing from the labor market. Rates comparable to previous generations.
Oh, really?
But you know, what about this business, about the whole concept of retirement? Are people, you know, less and less interested in work? What about the kinds of work they do?
The whole concept of work is under radical retirement. I know that baby boomers in far larger numbers than other generations say they wish to continue to work in some capacity. For most of us, that means working part-time or flex-time and not having a standard 9-to-5 job. Baby boomers were extremely hard hit by the Great Recession, and an awful lot of boomers, I think it's over 50%, don't begin to have enough saved for retirement. So it's not, for a lot of people, less a question of whether they want to work as whether they have to work. And then for them, there is the whole huge question of whether, as older workers, they will be able to find or hold on to jobs. Baby boomers are employed at higher levels still, I believe, than millennials. But if they are laid off, they have a much harder time finding work again. And most of us are going to have to continue to, you know, find some way to support ourselves in part in order to have a decent standard of living in retirement.
There's a view,
whatever retirement is.
Yes.
The word retirement is becoming obsolete. It's just being, you know, overtaken by this mix match of part-time work, the gig economy, barter economies, all sorts of stuff. And certainly we really, you know, this is one of the biggest asks, but we do need to revise our notions of productivity and to value the many ways in which people of all ages, but older people in particular, continue to contribute to the economy. For example, watching grandchildren so that someone with a paid job can go out and earn that salary. And, you know, more resources have always flowed from older generations to younger ones. So this notion of the greedy geezer is pretty much without basis, or this idea that old people are rich and young people are poor. The 1% is made up of young people and old people, just like the 99.
In the United States, you know, the only part of our social welfare system that is reasonably generous is Social Security, and so poverty rate among older people is lower than it is for younger people, and somehow this is perceived as unfair. Well, rather than a model for everyone else.
Right, and older and younger people have not worked long enough to pay into a system and accumulate the assets that older people, by and large, have done.
I'm speaking with Ashton Applewhite, who's the author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. This view of older people and their mental capacity is just mostly one, a popular view, is one mostly of loss. But is something gained also?
Well, absolutely. And I think the chapter in my book on the older brain probably contains more surprises than anything else. There is the finding, and I love that this was found by researchers at the University of Tübingen in Germany, I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it, who are like data science guys. They didn't know about old age, and they came, the lead researcher said he came into it a believer in what in the attractively titled dotage curve, which is the ageist and false assumption that as we age, all of us invariably lose cognitive function at some uniform rate. It is not the case. And what he found doing studying word processing in machines was an analogy that then played out in human models, that it can take longer to find the name of that movie or that book or that statistic because we, older people, have more data to sift through. But the really exciting thing about the human brain as we age is emotional benefits that aging confers. There's, if you Google U-shaped happiness curve, there's abundant data from the U.S. and around the world, independent of marital status, independent of socioeconomic status, that shows that people are happiest in the beginnings of their lives, in early childhood, and into their 80s at the end. It's literally like a U. And a large part of that is because as we age, and it tends to twig in into our 80s, and there are exceptions, of course, but it is true of most people, we get better at handling negative emotions and more emotionally resilient and more able to appreciate the present moment and less prone to worry. Older people, there's a guy named Carl Pillemer at Cornell who interviewed a whole bunch of older people about, you know, their lessons for living well. And the overarching message was like, not don't buy swamp land, but I wish I hadn't spent so much time worrying. And as we age, we become better at sort of prioritizing our emotional life. That's the neurological underpinnings of that U-shaped happiness curve.
Another thing that people worry about with age, of course, is the decrepitude of the body, and closely related to that, decline in sexual attractiveness, pleasure, desirability, all those sorts of things. So tell us why we shouldn't worry about that.
Are you finding less pleasure in it? I'm not.
No.
Well, there. So the pleasure is a myth. The big ask here is that we look more generously at ourselves and each other and reject the ageist myth that the only truly beautiful and sexual beings on the world are young people, right? I mean, where do the voices come from that say wrinkles are ugly? Who gets to decide that? You know, we know the answer, the beauty industry and the you know, the aging industrial complex. I mean, these messages that we have, that aging is decline and that aging is ugly and that aging is depressing, come from structures in society that make money when they medicalize things that are natural and uglify, you know, natural transitions or make them shameful, right? So they can sell us remedies. And if we can look more generously at each other and free ourselves up of that, it's like the body acceptance, you know, movement. Women who, you know, torture themselves their whole life because they have a big butt. Well, if you can accept the fact that it's your butt, you're stuck with it, it's kind of great, and men actually really like that big butt, you're freed of that. And we have, of course, a long way to go on this front about white hair, about wrinkles, about bodies that are not, you know, firm and bouncy. But there was a great blog post on the Huffington Post in praise of older women's bodies. I quoted in the book, and this guy says, you know, I love being in bed with an older woman because after that curve, there's another little curve. And, you know, a young woman's body is just this bouncy, flat plane. It's not so interesting. With an older woman, there's all this more there. And I thought, geez, how come I never thought of that? You know, these are different ways of thinking, but they are just as valid as an emphasis that youth is the way to go. I mean, if you think about fashion is another area that shows how malleable culture is, right? And in colonial America was a gerontocracy, which is not good either. The old people held all the power and young people had none. And what we want, of course, is an egalitarian distribution across all age groups, if possible. But old men held the power. And they think about what they wore, white wigs and stiff frock coats and stockings that exposed the lower leg. These are fashions that flatter the older body, right? There are no crop tops, no spandex. So we can change where we find beauty and make it a broader notion. That is a collective act, a political act and an imaginative act, and it is necessary that we engage in it.
It seems though that younger people have a revulsion against the whole idea of older people having sex, and even like the healthcare industry or the nursing home business. Like, the idea that people in nursing homes might want to have sex is policed.
Why would we stop having sex is the better question, you know. And with nursing homes, to be fair, there is an issue of cognitive competence. If people are really, really not mentally present, are they engaging in sex willingly? I believe firmly in the right to intimacy our whole life long, and I really, really hope to make my wishes very explicit. But if we want that freedom, we need to articulate it and protect it and not pretend it's not going to happen or pretend that it's also scary, it's ewy, and we don't want to think about it. We need to think about the kind of world we want to inhabit when we're older, and talk, same with end-of-life stuff. Talk about what we want and acknowledge that those needs are going to change. You know, I may think my sexual days are done, and then Louie moves in next door and things heat up. You know, I would hope to say to everyone, I'd like to be alone with Louie, and the do not disturb sign means do not disturb.
Well, I guess a lot of people, younger people, find it almost impossible to imagine being old. I remember being being in college in my early 20s, and like 30 seemed unimaginable at that point.
I remember when you were a kid and you ran everywhere and you were like, why do all the old people just sit still? Like, what's up with that? Yeah. I think it's very hard to imagine getting old when you are a kid. You know, it takes a long time and it seems really distant. But I think, of course, as we do age, it becomes less distance, and they say time goes faster. There are neurological arguments for that. And I guess you could say my work is, in a very literal sense, an argument to look at what age actually involves instead of the myths and stereotypes on which most of our way, way, way out of proportion dread and fear is based. Because there are actually studies that show that greater anxiety about aging is associated with less knowledge about the aging process. And so, you know, look at the older people around you. Look at them. Look in their eyes. Talk to them. Sit with them. Find out. I mean, you were talking about, you know, the people across the street from you who live in a residence for lower income, older people, and there they are toting their... I mean, you tell the story, you know, their oxygen tank on the bus, and what do you see in their faces?
Yeah, really a great attitude about life, and a joie de vivre that was missing in my much better off father in his final years.
Which, you know, maybe there's someone else in her room back at the home who's tethered to an oxygen tank and too depressed to go out. I'm not painting some rosy vision, but we cannot know what the experience is like until we are in it. And in an ageist society, all we see is the loss, and we project our fears. And the experience from inside is different, and life remains, for the vast majority of older people, very much worth living. There's the old saying that hardly anyone wants to live to be 100, but most of them are in their late 90s. We hold on to life for reasons that the rest of us need to acknowledge and respect and look at, right? Instead of just listening to the fear-mongering, which mostly comes from, you know, consumer and medical institutions that have to sell us.
Now, of course, that you're an established pundit on the question of aging.
Well, I believe that is the first time I've been called a pundit. That.
What kind of reactions do you get from people? Are they receptive, resistant? Is it all news to them? What's it like?
People flip out when they hear what I have to say in a really amazing way. And I mean, look at the reviews on Amazon. People say, you have brought out what is hidden in plain sight. all change, political, personal, starts between our own ears, right? And so the first ask is to look at our own attitudes towards our own age and aging and think about where those attitudes come from. That's a big ask. That's hard. You're being asked to confront your own internal bias, and we are all biased. I think ageist stuff all the time. So to look at that, but then if you're able to do that, then the genie's out of the bottle, and you start seeing ageist stuff around you. I mean, I hope that's true to your experience. Are you looking at me skeptically? There's also the fact that as we age, I mean, we hit these milestones that we are conditioned to dread. You know, you were saying when your 50th birthday came around, you acted like it was your funeral. Turned out, I'm presuming, not quite so terrible as you thought. So I think what the other reason the response is so fantastically engaged and positive is that even people who haven't begun to think about this in any kind of social or political context, they know, even subliminally, that their experience of reaching age X or Y is different from the standard narrative. And when I come in and explain why and say, you can run with this, not only to feel better about your own age and aging, but to change the way it's seen in society and push back against this discrimination, I think that's a very exciting message. I mean, people are saying it's a book for all ages, which I think it is, but it's very exciting that my readers are getting that. And they're saying we need broad political change, and I, the reader, need to be part of it. That's a trifecta.
That was Ashton Applewhite, author of This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism, published in March by Networked Books. You can't find it in bookstores easily, but it is easily available on Amazon. In a previous life, Ashton Applewhite, writing under the name Blanche Knott, was the author of the Truly Tasteless Jokes books of the 1980s. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Ellen Aline's remix of Roman Flügel's Mutter, German electronica 45 years after the Kraftwerk we heard earlier. Till next week, bye.